Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Jobs and the lack thereof has been the story of this recession. The July unemployment report we got this morning didn't do anything to change that. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com. And by Yellowbook 360, offering a spectrum of marketing tools for small businesses designed to go beyond yellow. More at yellowbook360.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, gang, the 6th of August. Good, as always, to have you with us. Sadly, it takes about a sentence to sum up this morning's unemployment report. The economy lost more jobs than expected last month and added fewer. The numbers go something like this. Only 71,000 positions were created by the private sector in July. The government let a whole bunch of census workers go, and Washington wasn't the only one laying people off. State and local governments cut 48,000 people. Those kinds of layoffs have been happening for a couple of years now at the state and local level, and that has big implications for the rest of the economy. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
Over the last year and a half, local governments have laid off more than 250,000 people. Another 250,000 are expected to lose their jobs over the next year and a half. Chad Stone is with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
Unlike the federal government, which can run a budget deficit, states have balanced budget requirements so that when the economy turns weak, they're required to find ways of bringing their budgets back into balance.
State and local governments are the largest employers in the country. To balance their budgets, they've cut back police, transit agencies, and education.
I received my notice on June 16th.
Precita Tuggle was the principal of a school in Jackson, Mississippi. She was laid off, along with more than 100 colleagues, after her state's education budget was slashed.
Our directors worked together to name a number that would be cut. My people told me, Tuggle, your name is on the list. And as it turns out, it was.
Meanwhile, the budget gaps keep growing. States are expected to be $140 billion in the red next year.
And that means we're still going to see a lot of job cuts, program cuts, and also tax increases.
Economist Mark Zandi has been traveling the country consulting with local governments about their budget issues.
State and local governments' tentacles run deep into the economy. This is one of the most significant threats to the fragile economic recovery.
Zandi says a bill in Congress now would pump $26 billion of federal money to states, but he says what's really needed is a recovery in the private sector that would create jobs and tax revenue. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
One glimmer of good news in the American job market might be a change in attitude by some companies. Some of them have started bringing back jobs they outsourced to China and other low-wage countries. Enough so that it's actually got a name, onshoring. From New York, Jill Barchet reports.
Earlier this week, Ford Motor Company announced it's bringing jobs that are currently done in India, Mexico, and Japan back to the U.S. Marcy Evans is the manufacturing communications manager at Ford.
You know, there are a lot of other costs that go into the equation when you are talking about where to source a product or a component. It's more than just labor costs that have to be considered.
She cites transportation and quality costs. Mark Kreiko is the president of Sleek Audio. 2.5 years ago, he shifted production of his earphones to China, but he's moving most of it back to Florida.
The quality issue was our biggest problem. It forced us to hire people to inspect each and every little item that was coming back from China.
Producing quickly can be more important than producing cheaply. Kevin Potts is a vice president at MTORIS, which works with companies on their supply chain costs. He says most of his clients are considering onshoring.
I think another perfect example was, you know, the Icelandic volcano and how that disrupted shipping. I mean, it caused a lot of just-in-time manufacturers to really rethink, should I have some kind of capacity here in the United States because I'm not getting the supply from Europe that I thought I would get.
Potts predicts more high-end production, such as medical device manufacturing, will return here. I'm Jill Barchet for Marketplace.
Remember that riddle from when you were a kid? What's black and white and red all over? The answer, if you spell red, R-E-A-D, is everybody now? a newspaper. Funnily enough, if you spell Red, R-E-D today, it's also a newspaper. The share price of the Washington Post Company tumbled deeply into the red, R-E-D, today, down almost 8%. The losses came despite huge gains in quarterly profits for the big publishing and television company. It's all about plans to limit the growing amount of federal financial aid that's paid out to for-profit colleges. If you're confused, here's the explanation from our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
This might come as news to all but the savvy investor. Most of the Washington Post Company's earnings in recent years have come from its for-profit higher education unit, Kaplan. Trace Urdin is senior research analyst at Signal Hill Capital Group. He says that's why the Washington Post warned today the ongoing congressional focus on for-profit colleges could really hurt its bottom line.
More and more, it's becoming an education company as the newspaper business is becoming a smaller piece of the pie.
Kaplan University and several other schools were recently investigated by the Government Accountability Office, and the agency's Gary Cutts told a Senate hearing this week the industry needs to clean up its act.
Representatives from 13 colleges gave our applicants deceptive or questionable information about graduation rates, guaranteed jobs, or they exaggerated future earnings.
Lawmakers are proposing a tighter rule on aid to profit-making schools. Analyst Trace Urdin says they'd have to meet certain graduation percentages and tie the likely earnings of a graduate to their loan amount.
In the case of Kaplan, they could both be having to raise their admission standards at the same time that they may have to be lowering their prices.
Urdin says that's bound to cut admissions, and he questions the end result.
It's one thing to say the for-profit schools have been sort of preying on these people, but the reality is that there's no other place for them to go. If you would have them go to community colleges, the problem there is instead of the student being on the hook, the taxpayer's on the hook, right?
Urdin says community colleges are subsidized by state and municipal taxes, and he points out they're all out of money. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Hewlett-Packard is the other company in the news this afternoon, most decidedly not in a good way. Right after the close, HP CEO Mark Hurd resigned. The company says it had nothing to do with its businesses. It's a sexual harassment case, apparently. Took a while, but Wall Street worked its way out of a jobs-inspired sell-off today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Later this afternoon, we'll get the latest bank closure numbers from the FDIC. Federal regulators have been spending large parts of their weekends the past couple of years shutting down troubled banks, 109 so far just this year. It is, though, quite a different story in Mexico, though. One firm in particular is opening new bank branches left and right down there. The name, I think you'll agree, has a familiar ring to it, Banco de Walmart. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports it's recruiting new business from inside its retail stores.
At this Walmart in Mexico City, all the cashiers ask the same question.
Señora, ¿usted ya cuenta con su cuenta de Banco Walmart?
Do you have an account with Banco de Walmart? And if not, do you want to open one? Many customers decline, not because they're happy with their current bank, but because they don't use a bank and never have.
7 out of 10 Mexicans do not have a banking account.
Antonio Ocaranza is a spokesman for Walmart de Mexico, also known as Walmex.
They pay in cash at our stores because they don't have a credit card. They don't have a savings account.
In the last couple years, Banco de Walmart has opened almost 250 branches with plans to add 100 more by the end of the year, all courting people who are new to banking. 40-year-old Karina Hernandez is a Walmart customer, but she doesn't use its bank.
Estoy cobrando muy poco, como 700, 800 pesos.
She says she only makes about $70 a month, so there's not much to save. Banco de Walmart is trying to lure such people away from the informal economy, where folks really do keep money under the mattress. Clemente Ruiz Duran teaches economics at the National Autonomous University of Mexico. He says other financial institutions in Mexico focus on the big fish, people who already have bank accounts, leaving all the little fish for Banco de Walmart.
They have a very specific niche, so I don't think that anybody will be competing with them.
The bank does not offer car loans or mortgages, but Walmex's Ocaranza says it does offer a credit card so customers can buy Walmart merchandise.
That will allow a family to buy their first TV set, their first refrigerator or washing machine and so on. Then we're also helping generate the sales for our units.
That's good for the bottom line at Walmex, and it does help poor folks establish a credit history. But Professor Ruiz says there's not enough emphasis on saving and investment.
They only help them to consume. People get indebted with things that they don't require, really, no?
Debt comes at a high price with Banco de Walmart's credit card. Get ready for this. The annual interest rate is 60%. That's about double the average in Mexico. The central bank has been talking about capping interest rates, but Walmex's influence can't be discounted. It's the biggest employer in the country.
Walmart already has tremendous power, and it would be a very difficult entity to regulate, sort of by analogy with our too big to fail debate.
Anna Gelpern is a law professor at American University. She's studied the regulatory issues surrounding Banco de Walmart. The majority owner, Walmart, is based in the U.S., where it's not governed by financial regulations because it's not a financial company.
So if the decisions are made in Arkansas, there is no U.S. regulator to talk to. Mexico is very much on its own as a financial regulatory matter.
Mexico is not alone in terms of Walmart's ambitions. The company recently launched new banking services in Canada. And Walmart is also making inroads in the U.S., despite previously being blocked from the banking industry here. Its Sam's Club division is taking part in a pilot program where qualified customers can get small business loans of up to $25,000. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
There are, depending on who you talk to, a whole bunch of ways to interpret today's unemployment report. The two people we are going to talk to are business writer Heidi Moore and Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine in a little segment we like to call our weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond. Lee, Heidi, good to talk to you both again.
Good to be here, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
All right, so it's jobs, of course. Heidi, you get to go first. What's your gut saying?
It's saying that it's pretty bad news, but we all knew that already. I think the major problem with what's going on with unemployment right now is that people are no longer being counted because we're having people drop off the unemployment rolls because they've been unemployed for so long. Mm. And the actual scale of how many people are not even on that list is actually the really stunning thing. And real unemployment, which counts discouraged workers and all of that, is at something like 22%, which we're really getting close to depression levels.
Lee, same question.
I would say that this is very reflective of what's going on in the broader economy. I mean, things are sort of stalled right now. And if you think back to March and April, we actually saw some job numbers that surprised to the upside. And today's report, it was really the third consecutive month of disappointing jobs numbers. And so any uptick that we had begun to see, we've really hit the pause button.
All right. So let me ask you this, though. The Fed meets on Tuesday to start talking about interest rates again. Last time Bernanke was on the Hill, he said, you know, if things get lousy again, the Fed will step in and we will do more to help this economy out. Is there a silver lining in this, Heidi, in that maybe the Fed and maybe Congress will say, hey, we really need to do something?
I think the problem is that we no longer live in a Greenspan world, but we have some Greenspan assumptions.
Wow. What does that mean? Greenspan. Okay. So the translation is?
The mystical wizard behind the interest rate curtain who can just fix everything with a flick of the interest rates. And you can't do that. I think that the problems in the economy have now backed up to such a point that although interest rates may help things one way or another, they are not a magical key. The reason that interest rates have been so low, in part for so long, is to help the banks. And now the squeeze is going backwards, right? The jig is up. The banks are no longer as profitable as they were, even though interest rates are still at zero. And so it's really time for the Fed to kind of loosen its grip on the banking system, start selling toxic assets back to the banks, which it wants to do, and also stop worrying that interest rates are going to be some sort of magic cure and just allow them to be a natural part of the economy.
So when you say that, you mean let interest rates go up, raise interest rates, no? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, nothing stays down forever, right? Yeah. What goes up must come down and vice versa.
Lee, what do you think?
I think something else that could be done would be to really focus on unemployment benefits, because we're getting to a cycle now where, you know, people that have been unemployed for 99 weeks are starting to lose their unemployment benefits. That just sets the stage for a downward spiral where people that are already really in tough times are just going to kind of slide deeper. And, you know, when people slip below the poverty line, there's a greater chance that their children will grow up in poverty. And it just begins this really depressing prognosis for the future.
All right. Let me end with this observation. If you look at the graphs of unemployment, the charts, you know, you see the big downward spike and then things got better for a couple of months. And now it's dipping again. I mean, is this now the first edge of the double dip, Heidi?
I think a lot of people are very worried about that, but we can't judge it just by jobs numbers. So, for instance, temporary census workers have been a huge variable over the past 6 months. So you can't throw all of your economic eggs in that basket. Certainly, it looks discouraging, but it's just a matter of finding the right emphasis in the economy and not just focusing on one metric or another and starting panic from there.
So we're sort of still having our fingers crossed, Lee, right?
Absolutely. I think it's too early to talk about a double dip, although people love to, you know, predict that that's what's going to happen. But I think it's way too early to talk about that. And I think so much of this is psychology. So when you get numbers like today, I mean, it just makes people nervous. It makes companies nervous. Companies have all these profits, as Heidi said, but they're not spending them. And until that happens, it's really hard to make any kind of prediction.
Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. Heidi Moore from the sadly departed Big Money. Guys, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up, they choose a farm, they send out an email blast, and then
people just show up, ready to do whatever work the farmer needs done.
We'll drop in on a crop mob, but first, we got to do the numbers. The Dow Industrial slipped 0.2% today, 21 points, closed at 10,653, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ slid 0.2%, 4 points, ended at 2,288. The S&P 500 dropped 0.3%, 4 points, finished at 1,121. For the week gone by, the Dow and the S&P 500 both rose 1.8%. The NASDAQ added about 1.5%. Kraft cooked up a gain of nearly 2.5% after reporting a jump in second quarter profits. AIG ratcheted up 2.5%. That after the company announced it turned an operating profit in the last quarter. Yes, that AIG. Banks looked a little shaky today. JPMorgan Chase slid 2%. Citigroup lost about 1%. Wells Fargo and Bank of America wobbled about 0.4% lower apiece. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.82%. Look out. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune in to Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the next Miss Black USA is crowned. The pageant takes place at the Lincoln Theater. No verdict yet in the trial of former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. Jury deliberations are expected to continue on Monday. And on August 9, 1974, Vice President Gerald Ford became President Gerald Ford, succeeding Richard Nixon, the first president ever to resign. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Bank of America has had its share of problems since the collapse of Lehman Brothers. It's been trying to absorb Merrill Lynch. It's had to find a new CEO to replace Ken Lewis. It's had to pay back its TARP money. And now it turns out B of A is on double secret probation with federal banking regulators. All right, so double secret probation is my interpretation. But Dan Fitzpatrick reports today in the Wall Street Journal that B of A has been operating under some confidential rules for almost a year and a half now. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
What do we know about this confidential memorandum and how it regulates Bank of America?
Well, we know that it's been in place for 15 months.
We know it requires the bank to take certain steps to improve its risk policies and liquidity management. And we know that it has to complete all these steps before it can be released. And while it's under the agreement, there are certain things it can't do. Like, for example, it can't raise its dividend, which was cut to a penny at the height of the financial crisis. So it's fairly restrictive, and if they don't take all these steps, there can be harsher penalties, which will be made public.
Help me out with that part, actually, because Bank of America is a publicly traded company. They got a whole bunch of money during the financial crisis. Why do they have secret arrangements with the government?
The thinking is that they can handle these problems privately and get them out of the way before they become too large and before the public needs to know about them, because once the public knows about large problems at banks, you have the concern about confidence in our financial institutions, which, as we all know, is something that regulators work pretty hard to protect.
Yeah, but there were huge problems at banks leading up to the financial crisis that we didn't know about, and look where we got.
Some banks do decide to disclose these sorts of agreements. It's rare. For whatever reason, B of A has not decided to do that, but they're pretty anxious to get out of it, to get out from under it.
Why are they so anxious? Is it affecting their bottom line?
First and foremost, again, there are certain restrictions, like they can't raise their dividend, and shareholders are clamoring for this dividend to go back up. Again, it's just at a penny. And regulators have much more control over day-to-day operations. And I think also there's sort of a stigma attached, and I think the bank is sort of desperate to shed that as they reemerge from a pretty tumultuous time.
So there was all kinds of discussion during the debate over financial reform about bank regulation, and the general consensus seemed to be that there wasn't a whole lot in that bill that just passed that actually went to regulating, increasing the regulation of how banks do business. Can we infer from this that there's actually more regulating going on than we know about?
I do think you're going to see regulators up in the business of these institutions for a long time to come, and I think it's going to take a while for regulators to act differently, because I think regulators are smarting from the criticism that they did not pay enough attention to what some of these banks were doing in the run-up to the crisis.
Dan Fitzpatrick from the Wall Street Journal and his story today about B of A's agreement with the government that I guess we're not allowed to know about. Dan, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
It's easy to lose track of or ignore where a whole lot of our food comes from. Processed meats, certainly, but tomatoes and corn and a lot of what you can find at a supermarket or at a roadside stand don't pick themselves, you know. So there is a growing movement that has the landless helping out on sustainable and community farms. Not for money, but not for free either. Janet Babin reports now from North Carolina Public Radio.
It's just before 9 a.m. on a sweltering Sunday morning in the South. A few dozen people, most in their 20s and 30s, converge onto several acres of farmland just outside of Pittsboro, North Carolina. They're here for an event called a crop mob. Co-organizer Trace Ramsey sips coffee and directs foot traffic.
Crop mob is meeting kind of around the corner. There's a couple tables. Hey, Bob. And we'll get started once we have a bunch of people. But there's water over there and some little bit of shade.
A crop mob is a bit like a community barn raising. Here's how it works. Each month, a host farm is selected. Facebook and email lists announce where and when, and people just show up, ready to do whatever work the farmer needs done. Today, the mob attacks Bermuda grass. It's overtaken some rows of organic watermelon. Farm manager Hillary Heckler picks up a shovel and shows the group how it's done.
So we gotta get under it, get the roots out, and any questions? All right, 1, 2, 3, dig.
Woo! Soon, more than a dozen people are whacking the weeds with all they've got. The work is hard, the sun today relentless, but the conversation's lively. Trace Ramsey, the greeter, was part of Crop Mob's genesis in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, back in 2008.
Crop Mob works on the model of mutual aid. It's not a free-for-all. It's not a charity. It's basically a model of reciprocity.
There are few rules to starting a crop mob, but one thing's non-negotiable. No money can be exchanged. And farmers who want Crop Mob to help out on their farm must first agree to work a mob somewhere else. Many smaller farms are more labor-intensive than larger ones because they don't tend to use a lot of big equipment, so the helping hands can be invaluable. Today, farmer Will Kramer's paying it back after a Crop Mob showed up on his farm a few months ago.
They helped us build beds and putting down a lot of mulch, which really set us up well for this spring, especially when we started having tractor problems. We already had the beds made.
Mixed in with the farmers are people with little or no experience. In exchange for their labor, the newbies get a meal and learn from professionals how to grow stuff. And that's it. 28-year-old Jeffrey Bailey lives in the city and works in a restaurant.
Our generation and the generation behind us have this blatant sense of entitlement. I think we're realizing that everything has come a little too easy for us, so putting our hands back and actually sweating a little bit is a lot more fulfilling than just being able to look something up on Google.
And crop mobs are spreading. At least 40 have sprouted up in 24 states. Trace Ramsey says its popularity is tied to a growing disillusionment among 30-somethings with white-collar careers. He and his peers were taught that manual labor is beneath them. But Ramsey says they're no longer satisfied with office jobs either.
At the end of the day, sitting in your cubicle after you've been done playing solitaire and hanging out on Facebook all day, what have you really done? So they're looking for an authentic work experience.
The Pittsburgh crop mob breaks about an hour early because of the heat. But they made a dent in that Bermuda grass. Now it's time to share a meal. Eggs, tomatoes, greens, all from the farm.
Hey, you guys, moment of silence for you guys. We just want to thank you so much for coming out here and sweating with us. And woo! Yeah!
It's just a few hours a month. But crop mob is convinced that this work strengthens community and fosters a connection with the land. In Pittsboro, North Carolina, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, today a 7-year-old girl running a lemonade stand in Portland, Oregon has gotten a taste of the downside of business. County health inspectors shut her down because she didn't have a food safety permit. Those temporary restaurant permits, they cost $120 a day. That's a tough nut to make at 50 cents, a cup of lemonade. So the county's top official has apologized. He's asked inspectors to use, quote, professional discretion from now on. But listen, the next time you see a kid doing a lemonade stand, stop by. Give him some business, will you? That's Marketplace this Friday afternoon from American Public Media. Today, the Dow slipped 0.2%, 21 points. The NASDAQ off 0.2% as well, 4 points. The S&P 500 dropped 0.3%, also 4 points. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Weston, the executive producer of the program, is J.J. Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, the American dream, homeownership, and Uncle Sam.
Without the federal government support right now, it would be reasonable to say there would be almost no housing market.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are back here same time, same channel, Monday afternoon. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.